Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast.
Happy Friday. I'm looking forward to the weekend. I hope you are as well. This is Shane Vanderhart, your host. Happy to be back with you after an extended absence in between dealing with some back issues I was having and then helping my oldest daughter, Kelvy, move to Kansas City and spend some time there. August has flown by fast. I do have a few things in the pipe for today. First, the new twist in the Mueller investigation that just broke today. Also, an evangelical U.S. Air Force general is in the crosshairs of an atheist group. And then I have a conversation with Sarah Abdush, who's the Iowa State Director for the Convention of the States Project, a group who seeks to have an Article 5 convention for the purpose of amending the Constitution with amendments that will help limit the scope and size of the federal government, as well as return power back to the states. Before we get to any of that, first, a word from our sponsors, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Robert Mueller's investigation has grown some tentacles, and we're getting into other unrelated Russian collusion crimes. I'm sure you're all aware by now that President Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was found guilty on 8 counts of bank fraud. Also this week, President Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, pled guilty on 8 charges, including bank fraud, tax evasion, and something directly connected to the president, 2 counts of campaign finance violations, which in the plea agreement, Cohen states he made 2 payments of hush money totaling $280,000 at the direction of then-candidate Trump to influence the election and avoid reporting contributions. Those payments were to two different adult industry actresses, I'm saying that diplomatically, for supposed sexual relations they had with the president and in order to silence them so they wouldn't speak out. And Cohen saying it so it wouldn't hurt his chances in the election. Cohen was later reimbursed for those payments by the Trump Organization. Trump's new attorney, Rudy Giuliani, who is also a former federal prosecutor and mayor of New York and also a former presidential candidate in 2012, he's saying the payments were legal and said Trump reimbursed Cohen. They're also arguing this is something Cohen had done in the past and it wasn't related to the campaign. Now, a new twist that we're hearing today was that the Trump Organization CFO, Chief Financial Officer, Alan Weisselberg, was given immunity in the Cohen case, which is interesting. The Wall Street Journal reported today that Weisselberg, who knows the ins and outs of President Trump's personal finances and tax returns, as he runs a Trump Organization with President Trump's 2 eldest sons, was given immunity by federal prosecutors in their case against Michael Cohen. Timothy L. O'Brien at Bloomberg Politics says or believes that this is a potential game changer. He writes, quote, Weisselberg's cooperation is a potentially momentous turn of events for the president. Depending on how prosecutors proceed, it may take the federal tax and bank fraud investigation of Cohen and, more important, special counsel Robert Mueller's probe involving Russian interference in the 2016 election out of some of the relatively low-stakes legal issues in play so far and into the heart of the Trump Organization and the president's business and financial dealings, unquote. He wasn't the only one to get immunity. David Pecker, who is a longtime personal friend of President Trump's and chairman of American Media Incorporated, that's the entity that controls the National Enquirer, was also given immunity in Cohen's case. Now, as far as Weisselberg's immunity goes, it's unclear whether or not it is limited to Cohen's case, if they needed him to actually, they needed to flip him to make their case against Cohen, which typically that's kind of backwards, since Cohen is a less important player than Weisselberg would be. So that's where this is a little unclear. It could be that it's ongoing. They got him to an immunity deal because of things he could tell them later on. We'll see. If it's ongoing, this could spell trouble for the Trump family. Time will tell. Now, the New York Times reports that the Manhattan District Attorney may also seek state charges in the matter. William Rasbaum writes, quote, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is considering pursuing criminal charges against the Trump Organization and two senior company officials in connection with Michael D. Cohen's hush money payment to an adult film actress, according to two officials with knowledge of the matter. A state investigation would center on how the company accounted for its reimbursement to Mr. Cohen for the $130,000 that he paid to the actress Stephanie Clifford, who is, I believe that's Stormy Daniels, who has said that she has had an affair with President Trump, the officials said. Both officials stressed that the office's review of the matter is in its earliest stages and prosecutors have not yet made a decision on whether to proceed. State charges against the company or its executives could be significant because Mr. Trump has talked about pardoning some of the current or former aides who have faced federal charges. As president, he has no power to pardon people and corporate entities convicted of state crimes, unquote. So this, of course, is premature, and since it's based on anonymous sources, I don't think it's necessarily incredibly reliable. A lot of the stuff gets leaked to hurt President Trump politically. Whether they're going to move forward with this or not, we'll have to wait and see. I think we can ascertain a couple of things here. First of all, none of this has anything to do with Russian collusion. Now, some of these charges could end up leading something bigger, like with Cohen's case, because in Mueller's investigation, he's finding different crimes that different Trump aides have committed, and he's trying to maybe get them to flip on President Trump. But that's far from certain. We're going to have to wait for the report to see what Robert Mueller says. Second, Trump's claim that he hired all the best people is, at least looking at the past record, his past record, patently untrue. Both Manafort and Cohen were corrupt. I mean, a jury of his peers, included even Trump supporters, found Manafort guilty on 8 charges of bank fraud. They wouldn't have found that if there was reasonable doubt. Cohen wouldn't have pled guilty if there wasn't evidence against him. And just setting aside the campaign violations on tax evasion and bank fraud. Now, some of Trump's supporters are saying that they're trying to Al Capone President Trump. If we can't get him on Russian collusion, we're going to get him on tax evasion, just like the former Chicago mobster during the Prohibition ended up facing prison time and was incarcerated because of tax evasion, nothing that he actually did with his criminal enterprise. So, you know, that's hard to say whether that's going to happen. I think that's premature as well. I think it's premature also to say that President Trump should be impeached because, you know, there's some dispute as far as whether what Cohen did was actually a campaign finance violation or not, and whether Trump actually directed him to do that or not. All that is up in the air, and frankly, it's relatively minor because even if that had been done and it was disclosed, you know, no violation as far as my understanding of the law. I could be totally wrong on that, but I don't believe that to be the case. I think it's premature to say, hey, let's start an impeachment process against President Trump. Third thing I wanted to mention, if you live a life above reproach, you don't have to worry about this kind of stuff. You don't have to, if you're paying your taxes and you're not lying to banks so you can get lines of credit, you know, if you're not lying about your debt, you don't have to worry about charges like this. You don't have to worry about payoffs if you're not having affairs. For instance, Molly Hemingway at the Federalist pointed out that Vice President Pence doesn't have to worry about any of this because it would be frankly, unbelievable that something like this would happen because of the way, you know, he's lived his life, and the hedges that he's put around himself to protect himself. Had Trump done the same thing, he wouldn't be in this boat either. So, anyway, moving on. A Air Force general, a Christian Air Force general, is being targeted. Newsweek, early last week, reported that the Military Religious Freedom Foundation filed a complaint with Defense Secretary James Mattis about Brigadier General E. John Tykert, who is commander of the 412th Test Wing of Edwards Air Force Base, and I also think he's the base commander as well. They accuse him of running an online evangelical Christian ministry for the last 5 years, they say is in violation of Air Force and Defense Department rules about religious proselytizing. They write, quote, Tykert, who flew combat missions over Iraq and the former Yugoslavia, according to his official bio, runs a website called Prayers at Lunchtime for the United States, Plus. On it, in addition to short essays on Bible passages and calls to pray to make America more Christian, he identifies himself only as John. The website doesn't mention Edwards Air Force Base, but Tykert recently posted a picture of his newly acquired general's epaulette star alongside a note about his new rank at the on the Plus site. Among the items on a long, they use scare quotes here, prayer list are, quote, a return to biblical foundation, appreciation for our national Christian heritage, appreciation for a nation formed, blessed, and prospered by God's power, and the unborn. Under About John, the site states, John is an active-duty brigadier general who served in the United States Air Force since 1994, who was saved by grace through faith in Christ in 2004. He has commanded at the wing, group, and squadron levels, and is currently serving as Air Force commander. The Lord has blessed his career while burdening his heart with the need for our nation to return to its Christian foundation, unquote. So, frankly, the complaint is ludicrous. No reasonable person should think that the Air Force has endorsed his personal website. There's nothing in the complaint that suggests that he actually attempted to share his faith while on duty with people under his authority. That would be inappropriate because they're literally a captive audience at that point. His identification of his rank and time in service is for biographical purposes only. Again, this is not a suggestion that the Air Force approves of what he's saying. There's no evidence that General Tykert compelled anyone to visit his website, nor is there evidence that he used his Air Force email to promote what he writes. And honestly, too, just because it's prayers at lunchtime doesn't mean that was written, you know, in the middle of the day when he's on duty, because you know, being a website administrator, you can schedule posts. You can schedule emails. There's a lot of things you can schedule, and you may not actually be on duty. So anyway, also, this is just an attempt at a radical group who wants to silence Christian soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen, even when they're off duty. Yes, there are some First Amendment restrictions on especially military officers. They're not allowed to criticize the president. For instance, which is understandable since he's their boss, but that doesn't mean all your First Amendment rights goes away. Should he have a disclaimer statement on his website? Yeah, probably. Is what he's doing out of bounds for, you know, what the military requires? I don't believe so. Now, it just seems to me that, you know, again, this is just trying to push him out of the public square. And fortunately, based on the Newsweek article, it seems like the Defense Department is not acting on the complaint. So I appreciate that. Now I want to turn to my conversation earlier this morning with Sarah Abdush. She's the state director in Iowa for the Convention of the States Project. She wants to see an Article 5 convention happen so we can amend the Constitution. The Constitution states, in Article 5, if two-thirds of the states petition Congress for a convention for proposing amendments, they have to allow it. Iowa was close to having its own petition pass. The resolution passed in the Iowa House last year but got tripped up in the Iowa Senate because of some resistance from some influential Republicans. We talk about what an Article 5 convention does and some of the common objections. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Sarah. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us again on the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. I know I promised you when we got off the phone last time that I'd have you back on to talk about your basically your biggest passion, that's politically speaking anyway, and that's Convention of the States. So welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. So first thing I want to ask you is, for just assume I know nothing. Obviously, that's not the case. I know quite a deal about Article 5, but a lot of our listeners may not. What is an Article 5 convention and why do we need one?
Yeah, so it quite simply, within Article 5 of the United States Constitution, there are two ways of amending the Constitution. One, Congress can propose amendments and those are ratified by the states, or the states can hold a convention to propose amendments and then those are ratified by the states. So there's two methods of proposing amendments. We are proposing to use the latter. We want the states to use that article to essentially restore federalism. We have a call that says to limit they would propose amendments to limit the size and scope of the federal government, essentially the power, the money, and term limit federal officials.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, and why I think should be fairly obvious. I mean, I don't know if you've tuned into the news today, but it seems like every day there's a new witch hunt. There's a new, you know, oh, Trump did this. Oh, this person did that. Oh, what if this person gets, you know, put on the Supreme Court? You know, we're in this constant state of concern as Americans. And the Constitution was intended to make sure that never happened. Mm-hmm. So if something is out of whack, then, I mean, we've amended the Constitution 27 times to date. It may be time for new amendments, and that's what we're proposing.
And those 27 times have always been through the first process, and that was through Congress passing an amendment and then the states ratifying.
Right? Yes, that's correct.
So this would be, has there ever been an attempt to have a convention of the states before?
Not of this sort. However, okay. A very interesting point on that. There hasn't been a convention to propose amendments, but there have been conventions to ratify. Back with the 21st Amendment, Congress actually said that the states should ratify using conventions in the several states. And it's pertinent because that had never been done before. It is a constitutional process, but we didn't really have any precedent for it. It kind of, to my mind, demonstrates how this process will go, even if, you know, the one was ratifying and the other is proposing. It's the same process. The legislature, once they heard this from Congress, essentially said, okay, and each state set out their ways of picking the delegates, and then they had orderly conventions, and then the 21st Amendment was ratified. So even while we have not had a proposing convention, we have had conventions in the states before. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what if, okay, I know one concern I've heard a lot about when it comes to an Article 5 convention is the concept of a runaway convention. What if, you know, are the delegates at a convention bound to the amendment, or not the amendment, but it'd be a declaration each state legislature passes to call for a convention of state. Are they limited to those topics?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason why we even know that is because to date, I think there have been over 400 Article 5 Now you got me thinking, forgetting the word as well. There have been calls for Article 5 to be invoked by the states in a vast majority of the states and on a vast majority of topics. The issue has been to this point, we have never had 34 agreeing topics. Now, if the topics must agree, the convention must be limited. And that's kind of basic common sense.
Okay, but there's just somebody would say it might be common sense, but this is politics we're talking about. There's no set is there's not any law or rule on the books that say that's the case, correct?
Well, that depends on the state, actually.
Okay.
There are states like Indiana that have set out kind of delegate restriction rules. So if the delegate acts outside of the call that the state has put on the books, because they're going as a representative of the state, they're a commissioner for the state. So they're acting in an official capacity. It's very much like an ambassador. So if they act outside of their role, it's up to the state to set what, I guess, what the process would be for dealing with that. Like I said, in Indiana, if a commissioner is, I guess, charged with acting outside of the limited call of the convention, they can actually be punished with a pretty massive fine, I think $10,000 or something like that, and then I think several years of imprisonment at maximum. So it is something the states have to decide, if it is important to them, if they think that their commissioners may try to make the convention run away, then they need to put in place the process for dealing with those commissioners.
Okay, so, but there's a chance that some states may not do that.
Yeah, absolutely. A state like California, it's completely their prerogative. If they wanted to try and throw a wrench in the works, they certainly could.
Okay, so it's not totally outside the realm of possibility,
Nope.
right? Okay, so if, but one thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that even if a crazy amendment gets passed from the out of the convention, it still needs to be ratified by the states, right? So.
Yeah. It's actually kind of funny on that. So at the convention, first of all, this has to pass a majority of the states, and that's, they have to have quorum, they have to make sure there's sort of essentially it would have to follow Robert's rules until the convention adopted whatever rules that it was going to act by. But they would probably do something like Robert's rules. So they would need to have a quorum though in order to establish the rules, and then they'd need to have a majority. It's very much like any other convention in that respect. And once that's established and once they voted on them, they can follow kind of whatever rules they want. But then, yes, you're correct. Any changes to the constitutional process must be ratified by 38 states. Now, that includes if they were to try to change the mode of ratification. And one of the ways that people will talk about this sometimes, they'll harken back to the original Constitutional Convention, which it's pretty unfair comparison because the Constitution obviously didn't exist at that time. We're using constitutional powers, not the residual powers of the states, which is, I mean, they were essentially making a treaty amongst themselves in a way. So it's one of those things, it's really not a fair comparison anyway, but they'll say that under the Articles of Confederation, which is what they pretend this original constitutional convention was called under, there was a mode of ratification and it required 100% of the states to agree to anything. At that convention, they proposed new rules. They proposed that it only takes 9 of the states to adopt the new constitution. Now, that's actually something that happened. The states were using their residual power. They were semi-sovereign entities at the time, and they were the ones that had called this. Congress didn't call it. It wasn't called under the Articles of Confederation. But whenever that went out to the states all accepted it, 100% of them. None of them said, "Hey, we're not gonna put together our ratifying conventions or anything like that because you changed the ratification process." 100% of the states agreed to the change.
Yeah,
So again,
there were some stragglers, obviously, but yeah, eventually they all came on board.
well, they agreed to the change. They didn't agree to the Constitution right away, but they did agree to the change in ratification mode.
Okay,
And
gotcha.
that's the key. But it's kind of funny because it's almost like we're viewing history and sort of all the political processes through this chaotic lens, as if there was no rhyme or reason to how things happened, as if our Constitution was a happy accident and not the work of very thoughtful men in a very thoughtful way. So it kind of boggles my mind a little bit because we're facing the same sort of process here. It's going to have concrete steps. It's going to be something, there are political ramifications for everything. There's going to be sort of the normal, I guess, conflicts of power that'll make states, guard their own selves jealously, which is what the founders and framers kind of bet on wherever they put this whole thing in place.
Right. So, a question I have, for Iowa, we had a resolution. I think that was the word we were looking for earlier, that passed the House. That in this particular General Assembly that needed in the first year of the General Assembly, and then the Senate was took it up, but unfortunately it didn't pass. As far as Iowa's concerned, what were some of the objections that you guys heard from Iowans or from people working against the bill in Iowa, and how would you address that?
Yeah, it's actually mostly been the runaway convention myth. It's kind of funny too. That's really what it all comes down to, is we don't want to act because we're afraid. We're afraid of our own constitution. We do not believe, and this is kind of me me putting words in their mouths a little bit, but this is the conclusion, is we're afraid of our state legislature. We don't believe they can handle their constitutional duty at the end of the day. And that's kind of what it comes down to.
Well,
That and
yeah. Well, I heard. How can we trust the state legislature to choose the right, delegates for a convention? I mean, it's like they're gonna send squishy people. They're gonna send people that. You and I wouldn't necessarily want to see as part of this convention, and other states are going to do that as well. Some quick question: how many delegates do each state get? How many do they get to send?
they actually can send as many as they like. It's one state, one vote, so it
Gotcha.
would,
Okay.
yeah, it would make the most sense for a state because they're obviously going to have to budget for sending those commissioners. It would make the most sense for them to send a delegation of 5 to 9 people. We do recommend an odd number, and then they would vote to vote how their state would vote, essentially.
Okay, all right, that makes sense. So, how do you address, people who say we just can't trust the state legislature to choose, the people? And do you know what that process would look like in Iowa anyway?
No, there are some processes in place that we've looked at, but it would be something we would have to set out. It's kind of funny, again, talking about the 21st Amendment ratifications. Whenever we were having a convention in the state to ratify that, they actually set out that each county would vote on a delegate, and they would vote. The delegates would run as either pro or con, and then they would be voted on and sent to this convention. So the counties actually had individual input in that scenario. There's been a little bit of talk in this about having a delegation of 9 people. And this is just kind of very hypothetical. It would include 3 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and these are all legislators, and then 3 citizens who are unaffiliated. And that way, there would be kind of a good mix in there of competing interests. Because, I mean, debate, I think we all can agree, typically breeds the best outcome.
Yeah, definitely. So, another I guess objection I've heard in the past is the federal government ignores the current constitution. Why would they adhere to an amended constitution?
Yeah, and that's kind of it's a falsehood we've been sort of told for a long, long time. I kind of believed that actually whenever I made my foray into politics, I really did believe that we were just kind of going willy-nilly and not following the Constitution at all. But the fact is we do. What we're following is essentially the Constitution as amended by the Supreme Court. A lot of people don't realize that every time a Supreme Court decision is handed down, both the majority and the minority, the dissenting and assenting opinions, both of those actually have an impact on how the Constitution is interpreted. Things like probably one of my best examples is the separation of church and state. How many times have we all heard that phrase? That is not in the Constitution. The wall of separation between church and state was actually, I think it was Hugo Black who said it in the majority opinion, whenever they were talking about whether or not public school buses could bus
Quote,
Catholic children.
quoting Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists, I think in 1804,
Yes.
where he was actually talking about the context of that letter was they wanted him to act on their behalf because there was an official church in Connecticut, and the context was the federal government can't big kind of Bigfoot over the church, and he was saying that in the context of protecting the church. So I always found that it was interesting that Justice Black used it. That took that phrase and then used it in the context he did.
Yes.
So anyway, but yeah, it's totally not constitutional.
Yeah, no, what the Constitution actually says is that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of any particular religion. So that means that Congress can't force people to join a state religion, because that's kind of the mode of happenings that was occurring all over Europe. Everyone had to be a part of, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, even we see that in a lot of Islamic countries, and they were well aware of all of that. It's very much a theocracy in some places. So, and they wanted to avoid that because they knew that theocracy is the antithesis of freedom, and so they wanted to make sure that that would never occur. But that's kind of just a great example of how things are read into the Constitution by the Supreme Court, and that continues to happen today. And we had to—I mean, we really have no other tools to fight against that other than trying to get a majority on the Supreme Court to rewrite the Constitution our way, which I think is, well, if you're talking about going by a constitutional process to amend the Constitution and going by five unelected, jurors on the Supreme Court, I think I would go with the former, actually.
Right. I would, yeah, when it comes to that process, it's like, can we just, I don't want conservative activist judges. I don't want liberal activist judges on the court. I want originalists. I want textualists, people who are gonna, just look at the text of the Constitution instead of seeing it as this living, breathing document, and then pulling, their own, I guess, values and where culture's at, and oh, let's see what this international law says, and different things, and trying to interpret the Constitution, with through those lenses. If we just look at the darn text of the Constitution, or and what the founders wrote about it. Speaking of the founders, one objection I heard at the Iowa GOP state convention, which actually I think they put a res a plank in the platform that spoke out against Article 5, which is the first time I think that's happened. I think we last convention put a supportive plank in, but anyway. They said that Madison, I believe, warned against Article 5 convention.
Yeah, it actually, that wasn't at the state convention. At the state convention, we removed the support, but did not put an opposing amendment
in. Oh, gotcha.
In,
okay.
But that was in the
District 3
platform.
I can't rely upon my memory.
Yeah,
is,
no, no,
this
no.
is me trying to remember. Okay, what? How? That was a long day. I was live blogging it. So, okay, yeah. I knew something significant happened with Article 5, but they repealed the support, but they didn't add opposition. Okay, but
yeah, but in District 3, they did include a resolution against it, and it did state that yes, Madison and Hamilton and a couple of other, they specifically listed these founding fathers, framers, and that was actually patently false. This is where we're getting into the territory of where I kind of get frustrated with people, mm-hmm. because they should know if they've read the context of these particular quotes that they're using. So each of these framers have said, we do not want a second constitutional convention. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody does. Nobody, I think we all agree that the Constitution is a very, very great document. It's not perfect. They didn't expect it to be perfect, but that's what the amendment process is for. But whenever they said that, they were talking about the fact that in that time, people were trying to say that there should be a second constitutional convention rather than approving the convention as it was. And that was a very big mistake, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's what they were talking about. They did not want a second constitutional convention. They wanted to make sure that this one got ratified.
That's an important distinction.
Yes, they weren't saying that you should never amend it.
Right. Well, and that was the phrase I heard several times from a couple of the speakers that spoke on behalf of repealing the plank out of the state platform was that Article 5 or Convention of the States is a con.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, okay, technically, if you're going to go by the stringent Black's Law Dictionary definition, any convention that has anything to do with the Constitution actually is a constitutional convention.
Okay.
It's very funny because they use that to try and conflate any sort of amendment procedure with the original constitutional convention, and they try and make this blanket claim that any constitutional convention is unlimited, which wasn't the case back in 1787, and it's not the case now. But the law dictionary definition, it's really kind of the worst sort of red herring, because it encompasses any sort of convention that has to do with amending a constitution, it ratifying a constitution, or proposing a constitution. So it can fall under any of those three categories. So it's really kind of a silly argument, but you know, it's very effective whenever you can shout con at a convention and get everyone worried. Mm-hmm. So,
all right. Well, is there anything that we haven't discussed or questions I haven't maybe asked that you'd like to address?
Yeah, actually, there was one that we kind of brushed up against, and then we never fully discussed, was, can our state legislature be trusted with this?
Yes.
It's funny to me because that question kind of, it supposes that things are going perfectly well right now, and that if we do this, it's going to blow everything out of the water. Hmm. I mean, you can already see the flaw in that argument. The fact is, Congress is not doing its job. It's delegated most of its authority to the administrative state. The Supreme Court is rewriting our Constitution every June. And then we have, you know, this presidency that is being completely, the role of the president has been degraded
conflated,
constantly.
Really. Conflated. I mean, it's expanding executive power. But it seems like at least the Trump administration, kudos to him that he's.
Well, no, whenever I say degraded, I'm talking about the way that people, there's no respect for the presidency
anymore.
Oh,
gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. No. I mean, even with President Obama, there were people who treated the office of the presidency very disrespectfully.
Right.
And then, you know, with Trump, it's gotten so much worse. So it's one of those things where nothing is working in our political system. I mean, actually, the Trump administration is working as hard as they possibly can, as well as they possibly can, which you have to appreciate them for, because they are rolling back executive orders, which was a massive expansion of presidential powers, the way that those were used. But to assume that things are working well at the federal level right now is a very big mistake. They aren't. The federal government needs to be reformed one way or the other, and it will never be reformed from within. It is an entity that will always try to protect itself.
Right.
So the only way to reform it is from without, and who better to do that than our state legislatures? I mean, I've gone down to the Capitol, I think, 3 or 4 times just this year alone, and I can talk to my state legislatures just face-to-face. I can talk to my state senator, my state representative. They're very accessible. They live in our communities. They're constantly here.
Mm-hmm.
They farm, you know, they are, you know, they're employed in the businesses around us. They provide our food. These are people we can trust. And even though it actually is very galling to me that we have people who have no faith in them, because I do. I think if they'd been faced with the 21st Amendment things, they would have come up with a perfectly good system for picking the delegates and getting that whole thing sorted out. And I know that whenever this passes in Iowa, they will do the exact same thing, because I've talked to these people. They're not stupid. They're very constitutionally literate, and they can handle it.
Okay.
They can handle it on behalf of the state.
Well, hey, Sarah, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about this. I appreciate it. It was very informational, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Hey, take care.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than our website, please make sure you go check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's spelled CAFFEINATED thoughts.com, or just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. You can also like us on Facebook. You can see us at facebook.com/CAFFthoughts, CAFF thoughts, or on Twitter, which is twitter.com/CAFFthoughts. You can also sign up for emails on the website so you don't miss a single article. Also, feel free to like me on Facebook. Actually, I guess you follow me on Facebook. That's facebook.com/ShaneVanderhart. And you can find me on Twitter at Shane Vanderhart. So I'd love to have you follow me as well. Also, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Be sure to give us 5 stars. Google Play, we're on Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and also on Spotify. If you're not a subscriber, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode, and you can listen using your favorite podcast app. So until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Have a great weekend.